but it is not clear where he is now. A US-based activist, Bob Fu, said Chen had clearly expressed that he did not want to seek asylum or go abroad. Chen is a blind, self-taught lawyer. He shot to prominence after exposing illegal abortions by local government officials in Shandong province. One woman who helped him escape has already been detained. There was also a clash between Chen's nephew and local officials, in which some people were injured. Sources say that Chen's nephew's house has also been surrounded by security forces. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
A live recording of Louis Armstrong playing his trumpet for one of the last times is being released today. It was recorded 41 years ago. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Charles Schwab, offering market commentary and perspective on changing markets online, by phone, or in a local branch. Learn more at schwab.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Used stereo equipment and thousands of CDs, records, and DVDs go on sale at Vintage Vinyl, Saturday, May 5th. Don't miss the premium sale from 8 to 11 a.m. The entrance fee is $5. Free admission begins at 11, and for more information, call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503. That's 217-333-6503.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. China is developing at a pace never before seen in human history. Our guest for this hour of the show, Michelle Damon-Loyalka, says that rapid growth has been made possible by the millions, literally millions of people who have left the countryside and have flocked to China's urban centers. She says these people are often overworked and underpaid, but she says there isn't a single Chinese city that can function without them. This morning in this part of the show, we will explore China's great urban migration, and that is the subject of the book that we'll be talking about here. The title is Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration, and it is published by the University of California Press. Our guest has lived in China for 13 years. She's done a lot of different things since she's been there. She's been a freelance journalist and editor as well, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. She's spending some time in the United States talking about the book, and we're very pleased that she could be with us. I think we're checking on something here. I just want to make sure that we actually do have our guest. Michelle, are you there?
Hi.
I'm sorry we lost you. I don't know what happened there.
I don't know either, but it's great to be on.
Okay, very good. Glad to have you with us. Among the things that impresses me a great deal is this item about you having done a radio talk show, co-host a radio talk show in Mandarin. There are times I can't even do it in English. So
I don't know how well I did it in Mandarin, but I tried.
Well, anyway, I'm really glad you could be with us. And I think it's such an interesting topic. This is something that we have certainly seen in other countries around the world, but it seems that it's just much more dramatic a kind of a trend when you take a look at China.
That's right. I mean, if you look at the Western countries, this transition from being predominantly rural societies to predominantly urban societies happened in the course of about 200 years. But when you look at China, it's happening all within the scope of about 50 years. So it's And it's on a much bigger scale, so it's, you know, it's happening so much faster and, you know, so many more people that it's really, for the society, it's such a dramatic transformation for people living there. For myself living there, even though I grew up in America, I felt dizzy by sort of the pace at which everything was changing, and you never really could rely on things being the same from week to week and month to month.
Yeah, it's the numbers here are really impressive. Apparently, in China, they're looking toward the day when the country will have more than 200 cities with at least a million people living in each of them.
That's right. So already there's 160 cities with more than a million people, but within, I think it's by about 2025, there should be about 221 cities in China with more than a million people.
Yeah.
And Europe only has 35 by comparison. All of Europe has.
It's just remarkable. And truly, the engine that is driving this, it is rural. The migration that is rural from the country, migration from the countryside to the city.
Absolutely. And this actually was the first year ever that the urban population now is more than the rural population in China. I think now it's 51% in the cities and 49% in the countryside, but that was kind of a big turning point.
Yeah. We have certainly heard a lot, and there's been a lot of reporting in the media about cities where things are really booming, and there are places like Shanghai and Shenzhen and Guangzhou, and there are cities around the coast, and that
right.
seems to be where a lot of the fastest-growing cities, at least for a long time, were, and apparently that was the result of a deliberate policy on the part of the Chinese government.
That's right. So when China started to really open its doors and reform its economy 30 years ago, it had this concept that they would first let a small part of the population sort of become prosperous, and then that those people would sort of pull everybody else up along with them. And so the eastern seaboard, like you said, you know, those boom towns that we often hear about on the east of China, like Shanghai, Guangzhou, and then also Beijing, the government invested lots of money and capital came into those areas, and they developed very quickly. But western China, which is actually the ancient capital of China, it's the cradle of Chinese civilization, and it's where the Mao kind of mounted the communist revolution, that was essentially ignored during China's transition period. And in the year 2000, the gap between Western China and Eastern China had grown so great that the government essentially stepped in and said, okay, we really have to start focusing on Western China a bit now. And so they started what is called the Great Opening of the West Policy, or the Go West Policy, which essentially was designed to start to bring Western China up to speed with the rest of the country. And so that's been going on now for 12 years. And I happened to be living in Xi'an at the time when this policy started. And really, when the Chinese government decides to do something, sometimes it happens almost immediately. So within a couple of months of this policy starting, building and construction just happened everywhere. So from my apartment, I could see at any given time about between 10 and 20 cranes on the horizon putting up new urban high-rises everywhere. And so it's really been fast-paced development of Western China. And in fact, what's happening now is that Eastern China, because it's been developing for 30 years, the cost of living now in there is becoming very high, and it's not as attractive anymore to factories, not as economical anymore for factories and companies to be located in Eastern China, where the standard of living is much higher. So we see now starting a trend where companies are starting to move towards Western China.
So, and you think that in the years to come, in popular media, we'll be hearing a lot more about what's happening in Western China?
That's right. I think, you know, Western China is the ancient capital of China, but it's also the kind of the new face of China. I do think that we're going to hear a lot more about it. And we are, actually. There's been a lot of big factories that have moved to the main major cities in the Western China.
Mm-hmm. Well, there certainly has been some reporting about Western China, but it's been about what's going on with restive populations that are not ethnic Han Chinese. So what led you to go to Xi'an?
Well, you know, I actually, because I wasn't a journalist when I first came to China, and so I had an opportunity to live in a village about 2 years after I had first come to China, and this was in southern China. And that village was a banana farming village in the mountains. It was very picturesque, and I really enjoyed it, but that was the first time that there had ever been a foreigner in that village, or even a foreigner, especially a foreigner living in that village. And so I sort of became like the local tourist attraction, and people would walk from neighboring villages to see if it was really true that there was a foreigner living there. And people would stand outside my windows and sort of watch what I was doing and make commentary about what they saw. So it was really a kind of a very unusual experience in my life, very memorable experience. But also it first started to make me think about what does China's rapid development mean for its rural population. And then from there, I moved to Xi'an because I could already speak Chinese, but I wanted to learn to read and write. And in Western China, the cost of living is quite low. So I moved to Western China, to Xi'an, to study Chinese. And very soon I ended up living in this high-tech area in Xi'an, and that's where all this new construction was happening. And yet at the same time, while I could see all these cranes sort of in the horizon putting up all these new housing complexes, there was also this old village right in the middle of all this new development. And that village was essentially where all of the rural migrants would live because they couldn't afford, you know, the standard urban housing. So they would come to this old village and rent out, you know, very small rooms. And that village originally had about 1,000 farmers, but now it was packed with about 30,000 rural migrants in about a five-block area. Mm. And so living there and sort of watching all of this unfold, you know, seeing these two very different universes unfold, that really first got me interested in writing about this topic.
Yeah. And what I think, the reason I think it's so interesting, and I'm sure that it's very important for people who study China, and it's something that I'm sure the Chinese government is thinking about, is that, you know, we have heard about how China is booming, and there have been all these stories about, again, about the coastal cities,
right,
and about how we have this rising middle class, and in fact, some people who are definitely upper middle class and have become wealthy through their entrepreneurship. But on the other hand, there were a lot of Chinese who were not sharing in the economic boom, and they were people who were living in the rural parts of the country, which is what China predominantly is.
That's right. I think that's important, and that's one of the kind of my goals when people read this book, is to realize that for all these sort of rosy forecasts we hear about China, China is really a country of contradictions. So it does have this rising middle class and this rising wealthy class, but there's still, like you say, a large part of the population is quite poor still. And I think it's important for people to sort of realize that, and to realize that underneath this economic boom is really just people like you and me who are trying to work hard for a better life. They're sacrificing a lot in the process, and they're facing a lot of difficulties and hardships and not necessarily partaking in the fruits of their labor.
Yeah, and maybe this would be a good opportunity for me to ask you about this Chinese expression, eating bitterness.
Right. So eating bitterness is this great term in Chinese that sort of means to persevere and to endure difficulties and to press ahead, kind of without complaining or, you know, stopping to think, is this right or is this what I want to do? It's just sort of, I guess you could say it's like suck it up. You just sort of move forward and don't really think too much. And so there's not really a term in English that can kind of encapsulate all that. So if you translate this term churku directly into English, it comes out to eating bitterness.
Yeah, and eating bitter, it is considered, your ability to eat bitter is considered to be a virtue and a sign of strength.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a long-held value in Chinese culture, but especially I think over the last 100 years or so, China's had quite tumultuous recent history. And so I think it's really forced people, especially people from the rural areas, to develop this quality even more. And I didn't set off, when I started to do the research of the book, I didn't set out with this as the title, but in fact, as I talked with migrants, over and over, they themselves brought this ability to eat bitterness up as sort of the key to their ability to stay in the cities and to survive despite all the difficulties that they face. And essentially, I think it's been the key, it's kind of like the secret to China's ability to move forward so fast over the last 30 years, because it not only does it have a, you know, very large and pretty inexpensive labor force that can rely on, but it has a labor force who's has this spirit of just pressing forward through the difficulties.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Michelle Damon-Loyalka, is a freelance journalist. She has lived in China for 13 years, and she is the author of a recently published book. The title of her book is Eating Bitterness, the subtitle Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. The book's published by the University of California Press, and it does indeed look at this big demographic trend that you see in China. That is, this very rapid transformation of the country from a rural agrarian society to an urban society, something that has been accomplished very quickly. And if you look back in history, something that in China has happened much more quickly than it happened in most Western nations. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, just to explain what life would be like for people who, say we're living in the city village in Xi'an, yes, you have to explain in China how it is that people connect with entitlements that government provides, and certainly there are things that government provides,
right.
but it's linked in a way to where they think you're supposed to be, and if you move, your benefits don't move with you.
That's right. So China has what's called the Hukou system, or the household registration system, and actually they've had some version of this on and off for the last 2,000 years. But the latest sort of reincarnation of the system was implemented by Mao in the late 50s as a means to prevent the rural population from fleeing the countryside once collectivized agriculture began. And so essentially what happens is that at birth, every resident is assigned to a location, you know, to the location that they belong to, and they're also assigned as being either a rural or an urban resident. And this isn't based on where you're born, but it's based on where your parents are registered. And so once you're ascribed to being a rural resident, it's very difficult to ever change that. Essentially, the only easy way to change it is to go to college. So if you can get into college, you essentially can change your housing registration and become a full-fledged white-collar worker. But otherwise, typically, you're a rural person for life, and most likely your children will be as well. And so in China, rural and urban aren't just adjectives, they're actually legal descriptions. Mm. And, you know, before when it was started, the policy was trying to prevent movement. The government doesn't use the system like that anymore, so people are basically free to move about as they would like. But like you said, what the government does still use the system for is to allocate benefits. So everyone in China is entitled to subsidized health care, to free education for their children, but you're only entitled to those things in the place where you're registered. So obviously for people who are registered in the countryside but then migrate to the cities, they're not registered in those cities where they come to, and so they're often denied access to affordable health care. Oftentimes their children cannot enroll in urban schools, and so it's really creating something of a two-class system. There's the official urbanites, and then there's this class of migrants who live in the cities, but they're not recognized as official citizens of the cities, and they're not entitled to the same sort of benefits. Hmm.
So the government knows, it certainly has to know, that these thriving urban areas, they are thriving because of the labor of these economic migrants, people who come from the countryside. But the government also has to know, because of this system, that these people may be having a difficult time, or at least they're not collecting the kind of benefits that theoretically they're entitled to as Chinese citizens. So how does the government think about that, and does that worry them that it seems like there's a kind of exploitation going on here?
Yes, you're absolutely right. The government is very aware of these issues. They're very aware of how critical migrants are, both to the development of the cities, and I should say they're also very critical to the development of the countryside, because migration in China often isn't a one-time event. People kind of come to the cities for a few years, then they go back to the countryside again, then they come back to the cities, and it's kind of a circular migration pattern. And so every time the migrants go back to their homes in the countryside, they bring with them new knowledge and skills and capital, and they are largely also essential for sort of improving the quality of life in the countryside. So they're really key to both the development of the countryside and the cities. And so the government is definitely very aware of how crucial they are, and also to the difficulties they're facing. And in the recent years, the government has been talking increasingly about their contributions and trying to level the playing field. But, you know, when you think about 300, within the next 20 years, the number of migrants in China will increase to about 300 million people. And if you think about that, that's the entire population of America, essentially. So if we tried to move every man, woman, and child from wherever they are in America to some other location, everyone has to find a new home, a new job, I think, you know, it would be chaos, definitely. Mm-hmm. So I think if we think about it in that terms, we can see, the enormous challenge it is for the government, and also the potential for things to go wrong at multiple levels.
Yeah.
So the government is definitely trying. They've done a lot of things like expanding the higher education system so more people have the opportunity to be college graduates. They're also implementing a whole system of vocational education, and they're having pilot projects to sort of start of reform this housing registration system. But I think because it's happening so fast on such a large scale, it's difficult to sort of keep pace with what's happening. And so the government recognizes that this is one of their, you know, critical challenges in the coming decades. I have heard several government leaders in different bureaus saying that, you know, in the next decade or so, this is their key challenge that they're focusing on, is helping migrants to sort of have equal rights with urbanites. But actually, I'd also like to mention that, you know, a lot of talk, especially in Chinese media, about getting rid of this household registration system. But the problem is actually is that oftentimes rural people do not actually want to change their registration, because along with that housing registration, if you're labeled as a rural resident at birth, you receive an allotment of land. So in China, once collectivized agriculture ended, they essentially took all of the farmland and divvied it up among the rural people. And so at birth, if you're from the countryside, you receive a parcel of land and it's yours for life. It isn't, you can't sell it, and you can't let it go fallow or you will lose it. And when you die, it goes back to the village to be redistributed to the next generation. But otherwise, it's yours for life. And for people in the countryside who, you know, just a couple of decades ago were facing starvation, this is seen as a really key benefit. In fact, it's their main source of social security. And so a lot of migrants, they're not really willing, even if they have the opportunity to change to a city registration, they're not really willing to trade in their rural registration, which would also mean trading and giving up that piece of land. They're not really to do that in exchange for an urban registration, because a lot of times they don't feel they have a lot to offer in the cities, and once they're sort of, their bodies have broken down and they can't do sort of just manual labor anymore, there won't be a place for them. That's what they're afraid of. So they want to keep that parcel of land back in the village, that whenever they're ready, they can go back, and they know that they still have, you know, a means of supporting themselves back in the villages.
And it's not exactly like it's great wealth, but on the other hand, it is, I'm sure, a very important, very valuable asset. The idea that even that would be a way for you, say, to maybe to feed yourself and your family. You're not going to be growing stuff that you're going to be selling, but
right.
it's something that you can live on.
Exactly. It's a sustenance insurance plan, essentially.
Yeah.
Make sure you can always support yourself.
At the same time, I know you've talked about how when you try to explain to these rural folks who have these really small plots of land, the idea that, say, in the United States, there would be somebody who would be farming 300 acres, that they just can't quite even grasp the notion.
That's right. And especially, I remember one older woman, I write about her daughter in the book, and we had gone back to visit her mother in the countryside. And her mother asked me, you know, how much land do farmers in America receive? And I tried to explain to her, well, farmers in America don't receive land. You have to buy the land, or maybe perhaps your parents own land and they pass it on to you, but you don't just receive land from the government. And she really couldn't understand. I tried several ways to explain it to her, but eventually her daughter had to step in and really make her understand that there's not such a policy in other countries. And the mother heard that, she said, oh, you know, how can they be so cruel in America that they don't even give farmers land? So it's definitely a totally different way of sort of conceptualizing what it means to be a farmer.
Yeah. Here, again, so through some of the reporting of what's going on in China and its big growth, and particularly, again, of coastal cities, we've read these stories about people who come to the city to work in factories. And also we've read about what working conditions for them are like.
Right.
And while there certainly are people who have moved to the city to work in factories, apparently the bulk of the people, they're not working in factories. They're doing all kinds of things, in many cases, basic manual labor, all of those things that in a city where you have a lot of people, you have to have somebody to do.
That's right. Yeah, I think the impression that probably in America people have is that most migrants work in factories. But in fact, less than a third of all migrants are in factories. And I purposely excluded factory workers from my book because they comprise something of a migrant subculture where they're kind of isolated in their factories, because a factory in China will not just be a place where you work, but it also gives you a dormitory. There's also the cafeteria. Sometimes there's movie theaters. It's basically like a whole little residential compound into itself. So factory workers tend to be somewhat isolated from the broader society. But the other two-thirds of migrants, they, as you say, are very intimately involved in every aspect of China's own domestic life. I mean, they are nannies and housekeepers. They sell vegetables. They are the security guards and people who work in cutting. They cut hair. They do construction. They do all kinds of things that really are essential for helping city life to run smoothly. And I actually had an idea about a month ago before I came back to the U.S. that I wanted to write a blog post kind of documenting how important migrants are to city life in China. And so from my house in Beijing, my idea was I would leave my house and sort of take a picture of every migrant I encountered and write a couple of lines and kind of see in one day how many people I was depending on. But in fact, by the time I left my house in the morning and I walked what's typically a 20-minute walk to the subway stop, I already had to give up the idea because it was just overwhelming. I was encountering too many migrants, and it was taking the whole day, essentially. So it really made me realize that every aspect of life in Chinese cities depends on migrants.
Well, and because of, you explained a little bit earlier about the system of registration.
Right.
That people, you're registered maybe not necessarily where you were born, but you're registered where your parents were born. So if you're registered, as a rural person, and then you come to the city, the problem that you have is hooking on to government services. They're connected with your registration. So
Right. That
might make it difficult for your kids to be in school, for you to get health care, a variety of things. And what you end up with, as you have explained, is a kind of, in the cities, this kind of two-class system between the people who are registered in the city and the people who are living and working in the city, but they're registered in the country. So how do city people, the people who are registered as urban people, how do they look at these urban migrants?
Well, that's a good question. I think, even the term for these migrants is called the floating population. And in Chinese, it sort of has the connotation of being people who are a bit unstable. They're constantly on the move. It's somewhat derogatory of a term, and I think there's definitely the perception that migrants are of lower quality than people from the city. And, sometimes even if migrant kids can get into the city schools, the official urbanite parents, they don't want migrant kids in the school because they feel like they'll sort of lower the quality of the education that the kids in the school are receiving. So there's definitely a lot of prejudices happening. But on the other hand, I have to say, like, before I came to the U.S. this time, I gave some talks in Beijing about the book and about the issue of migration. And there's definitely a growing awareness of the injustices that they face, and people are concerned, especially on campuses. I noticed that the students there are really concerned and, really were looking for ways to sort of change the system and make it fair. So I think there's definitely people look down on them, kind of generally speaking, but there's definitely this rising awareness that it's not a very good system and that needs to change.
In this hour of focus, we are talking with Michelle Damon-Loyalka. She's a freelance journalist. She's lived in China for 13 years, and she is the author of the book Eating Bitterness. The subtitle is Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. It's published by the University of California Press, and indeed looks at this important demographic trend. It's something we've seen certainly other places around the world, but in a very, very dramatic way in China. This big movement of people from the countryside, from rural areas to the city. And that's what the book is about. Questions here are welcome. We have somebody ready to go. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller on our line number one to bring into the conversation. Hello.
Hi, good morning. This isn't exactly the topic of migration, but I wanted to return to the topic of the factories in China, because I know there's been a lot of recent press with the Apple outsourcing. But I'm asking because I was in a class at the U of I, and the professor showed us a documentary that showed a factory in China that made the beads that are thrown around during New Orleans Mardi Gras. And she showed us this film, and it was one of these campuses you're describing where a lot of young people live and they eat, and there's cafeterias, and they're working around the clock and these shifts and 7 days. Well, I don't know if it's 7 days a week, maybe 6 days a week, but it's pretty intensive labor, very repetitive labor. And so the professor said, therefore, I boycott beads. And I remember thinking to myself, well, everything we have here practically is from China. That's number one. But number two, I wonder, how we should perceive these factories and if these jobs are things that are considered you know, horrible or bad, or if people actually seek out these jobs and if they keep them for years and years and even multi-generationally. So I'll hang up and listen about how we as Americans should perceive this factory labor. Thank you.
Okay. Well, can you answer that question?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Definitely, I think the way Chinese migrants perceive their own condition is very different than people in America who are thinking about buying these products perceive their conditions. And I'd like to say that, and this isn't a justification for any sort of abuses that might happen in factories, but in my experience, migrants who don't work in factories and migrants who actually are self-employed, they choose to live essentially in the same sort of conditions. So in Eating Bitterness, there's one story of a family who are vegetable vendors, and they work every day from 3 a.m. because they have to get up to ride their bicycle across the city to buy the vegetables at the wholesale market. And they work from 3 a.m. to 9 p.m. every day. That's 18-hour days, 7 days a week, 360 days a year, and they've been doing that for 12 years straight. So, and they live in a one-car, what's essentially a one-car garage. So they have no windows, they have no heating, they have no plumbing. They cook in the hallway, like a common hallway in the building. And so you would look at them, and what I assumed when I first met them is they live like this because they're essentially destitute. You know, they don't have any other choices. But actually that's not the case. They live like that because they hope to save as close to 100% of their income as possible. And so, you know, in the last 12 years, they've amassed quite a bit of savings. And so I think that the same is with factory workers, that people come and they are willing to work long and hard hours because they want to save money for the future. They want to send money back to their families who are in the villages still. And from what I understand, in a lot of factories, when they sort of try to cut down on overtime work, the migrants typically tend to quit because they're there for the express purpose of making money. And even though they may be tired, even though overtime may be very long, they would rather do that and save more money than to sort of take it easy while they're in the cities.
Okay. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So do people, like the people that you have profiled in your book and that you have met, the people kind of we're talking about, do they have a concept of upward nobility? What do they think about not only them bettering their situation, but their children?
Well, that's a good question, and it's hard to say that, you know, one answer for all migrants, because there's lots of different migrants at different kind of stages in their lives. A lot of the migrants that I've met who say maybe are in their early 30s and they have children, their goal essentially is just to provide a better life for their kids. So they go through all this with the express purpose that their children will have more to offer society, that their children will grow up with more skills and more abilities that they can not have to just do sort of hard manual labor. Then there are migrants who have become more successful than, say, the typical migrant. There's a chapter in the book of a woman who has a sheet shop, and then she later opens up a hostel, a little hotel. And she's definitely thinking about wanting to sort of leave the city villages where it's still kind of like rural life and sort of integrate fully into urban life. But there's definitely still sort of a glass ceiling in her way. She doesn't exactly sure how to make the step from migrant life into being a full-fledged urbanite without changing that registration. So I think migrants, they have different motivations, but definitely the average migrant, I don't think, is necessarily for themselves thinking about upward mobility. They're thinking about sort of plowing ahead, saving money for their, one is for children's education, because, for example, education in China, if you're going to send a child to university, let's say, the cost of tuition is, you know, more than 120% of an average farmer's salary. So a lot of migrants are out there saving money for their children's future education.
Mm. That's something that I guess surprises me a little bit. I would think in a country like China, it would be a situation where if you had somebody who was smart enough to go to college, that the country would say, okay, if you can do college work, we're going to make sure that you get a college degree. But in fact, people actually have to pay for college.
Well, yeah, it's not as such an easy thing just to say if you're smart enough, you can go. For one thing, if you look back in 1990s, China only had enough slots in the higher education system for 4% of the people to go to college. So, you know, that's an awful lot of smart people who aren't in the top 4% who still can't go, just because there's not enough universities and not enough slots. But since the 90s, China has made a lot of efforts to sort of rapidly expand the higher education system. And so today, about 25% of all 18-year-olds will have the opportunity to enter college. But the problem comes in is that China also has, I guess, you know, we have the SAT and ACT tests as well, but it's a very competitive college entrance exam to get into university. And people who have gone to school in the cities, the city schools tend to have better education, and so kids from the cities are much more likely and they're to go to college than kids from the countryside. So, and also in China, there's, I should say, that there's only 9 years of compulsory education. So essentially everyone is entitled to free education through ninth grade. But after ninth grade, you have to test to get into high school. And so again, in the countryside, only about half of the students are even going to go to high school. And then out of that half, how many will go into college, you know, is much smaller yet. So it's definitely a big issue, and they're trying to expand the higher education system, but it takes time to build all those schools and make slots for more people. So it's happening, but it's taking time.
Yeah. Oh, people, we know here that people in China, people other places, people move from the country to the city for economic opportunity.
Right.
And as you explained here, we have people who, they take the jobs that they can get. People work really hard. They live as frugally as they possibly can, because what they're trying to do is sock away as much of their money as they can so that they can take that and then go back home. They can invest that in their homes and in their children. And so they're willing to put up with a lot. That's this whole, as you explained earlier, that's this whole business of eating bitterness. That is the idea to persevere, to put up with what you have to push ahead, and that's a sign of great strength. So having said all that, though, you wonder, among these kind of people that we're talking about here, people who have moved from the countryside to the city looking for a better life, is there any sign of discontent? You know, are there people who are saying, I am tired of eating bitter?
Oh, absolutely. So especially the younger generation, because migrants are also in China getting younger. Now I think it's about 70% of migrants are under the age of 30. So especially among that group of people, they are not as willing as the older generations to sort of just continue to eat bitterness, you know, endlessly. I think they're definitely willing to still go through hardship and difficulties, but not without the sort of clear expectations that it's a temporary means to a more comfortable end. And so that's a challenge for China. So we've seen this younger generation of migrants wanting higher salaries, wanting better benefits, wanting shorter hours, wanting to work in places that are closer to their homes. And so this is, you know, the development model that China's kind of depended on for the last 30 years has really relied on this ability of people to sort of endure whatever the situation is and not really have too many demands. And so as this younger generation of migrants sort of changes and has more expectations, I think it's really a challenge to China's entire development model. And they're probably, you know, they really are going to need to rethink that and come up with a model that allows for better conditions for migrants.
Yeah. Well, there's something that, and I know you've written about this recently. You wrote a piece that was published in the New York Times that is very striking, having now talked about this, that this shift of workers from urban to from rural to urban, this trend that has really fueled the country's economic growth, it may be that in China they're going to start to see this coming to an end, because the pool of available workers is starting to dry up. And also there, I'm sure that there is a demand for, when that happens, there will be a natural kind of increase in wages. And I'm sure people are going to get to the point where they're going to demand increased wages. And in fact, I think that in this piece that you argue that China is actually starting to experience something of a labor shortage.
That's right. The labor shortage is especially kind of obvious after the Chinese New Year, because usually for the Chinese New Year, millions and millions of migrants, hundreds of millions of migrants, I should say, go back to the countryside. And then it generally every year they have a real hard time getting people to come back to their jobs when the holiday is finished. And so definitely, but aside from the spring festival time, this holiday time, there's other times when there's been labor shortages, and they're starting to see that now in the East, because as I mentioned earlier, the cost of living now in the East is quite high, and migrants are less sort of willing to go there because the costs are high and they don't want to be far from their families. And also we're seeing, kind of compounding this problem, is that the conditions in the countryside are getting better. So a lot of people are not quite so willing to leave anymore because the conditions in the villages are better and there's more opportunities. They're starting to build more sort of local small enterprises in rural areas as well. And so people, if they have a choice and if the salaries are somewhat comparable, then they're starting to choose more to stay put and not to head to that eastern seaboard anymore.
Yeah. We have about 6, 7, 8 minutes maybe left in this part of Focus. We're talking with our freelance journalist, Michelle Damon Loyalka. Her book is Eating Bitterness, and it's published by University of California Press. We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them both. Next is line one in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for this enlightening program. I have a question pertaining to property ownership and how the migrant people are able to even identify properties of where they would move and how that process works and if there is actually ownership of real estate there. Could you address some of those issues? Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So, as I mentioned earlier, most rural people sort of own, not exactly own, but have a plot of land that's theirs. And they also have a homestead, a plot of land where they have a homestead as well. But when they get to the cities, they typically, it's, you know, rural, urban real estate is very expensive. Most migrants don't, the average migrant doesn't own property, I would say, in the cities. But what they do, like how do they locate places to live? So there's this phenomena in China of the city village. And essentially what that is as urban areas continue to expand, they buy up the farmland of villages. But they don't tend to buy up the cluster of village homes. So, for example, the place that I write about in Eating Bitterness, there was this high-tech zone that was built on the farmland of this old village. And the farmers received a payout for their land, and what they essentially did with that money is they added on to their homes because, again, they didn't buy up the cluster of village homes. So the farmers built up their homes. Sometimes they just tore them down completely. When they used to have a courtyard, they turned it all into home. And when migrants come into these urban areas, these new urban areas looking for work, that's the kind of place that migrants will go. They will find these old city villages that are, you know, right in the middle of the new urban development, and they will rent out rooms there. When I say rent out rooms, typically the average size of a migrant's living space is 8 square meters. So we're talking about essentially a bed with a little walkway around it. And they will rent out rooms in these city villages, and that's essentially where they live. So they become migrant enclaves, essentially, the old villages. And that's kind of actually the way, it's essentially the way that China has avoided having the sort of absolute poverty urban slums that you see in India or Brazil or other countries like that.
Okay. I hope that in part answers the question. We'll go one more here. Also Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Very fine program. I need a couple orientation points first here before I make my comment and ask my questions. I came in a little late. Madam, where were you born?
I was born in Wisconsin.
Ah. And you've lived in China for how long now?
13 years.
Okay. Do they have any drug abuse in China?
They do. They do have, yeah, they do. I don't know too much about the statistics on that, but
okay.
Definitely they do.
Do you have any feel for whether it's less than we have, more or equal?
I would say less, generally speaking.
Okay. What percentage of Chinese children have time to spend doing video games? Are you have an idea of that?
Well, that's a pretty serious problem in China, the addiction to video games among the kids. I don't know percentage. I mean, the kids study very hard, but then they also have a big problem with addiction to video games.
Did you use the word addiction?
Yeah. There's definitely some of that in China.
Oh, okay. Well, a little comment from my part. I've enjoyed listening to you. You've been very instructive, and I thank you. I'll say this, I remember when I was a child, there was this quaint American idea of saving money. And, I think it's very interesting that the Chinese are still very much into that. Now, my bigger comment for the audience why it is, I think you've done a superior job of explaining why we Americans should be totally suspicious of any of our politicians that gets up and talks about how we need to change China, blah, 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 blah. I remember the stories coming out of Germany when there was the East German amalgamation. Those people could not figure out how to reorient their minds and adjust to the capitalism. And your story about the elderly Chinese woman thinking how cruel we were to the farmers, et cetera, over here, I think is ample opportunity to make the point that the Chinese people's minds are not going to be able to adapt to our style of living, and we'd probably best just leave them alone. I'm thinking they're better off now than they were 50 years ago. Would you agree?
Yeah, 50 years ago, China was in a pretty bad spot, I would say, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think 50 years ago, excepting for certain technological advances and a few cultural changes, we were better off.
Well, I would definitely say that China is, even though it isn't officially called a capitalist country, in many ways it's very similar to living in the U.S. It's definitely materialism is coming very quickly, and capitalism is part of that.
And we just have, I appreciate the comments to Colin, we have like about a minute or two, but this does raise a point that I wanted to get to. Maybe you can at least talk about it for a minute or two, and that is, you know, what people are thinking about in China once you get to the point where people are doing better economically, and they're being able to maybe satisfy some of their material desires, then what do people start thinking about? And what is it that they then start wanting?
Well, that's a great question, because in China, when the reforms, economic reforms started 30 years ago, people really had the mindset that we have to only focus on material progress. Anything else besides thinking about material progress is sort of a distraction. And first we have to become materially stable, and then we can think about everything else. And so for 30 years, people have essentially done that. But like you said, now there are more and more people who are becoming wealthy, or, you know, at least kind of reaching their goals that they set out for themselves, or exceeding those goals. And so really in China, you're seeing a resurgence of a lot of things that before were seen as distractions, like religion, like social activism, environmentalism, philanthropy. All these things are on the rise, and I think that is a sign that, you know, as China develops and people do have more material stability, they're realizing that that can't be the only thing in life, and they're starting to look for more purpose. And I think that even among migrants, that will happen too. At some point, migrants are going to kind of stop just blindly eating bitterness and enduring difficulties and start to really assess the journey that they're on and start to want more out of life.
Yeah, and just in an interview, one of the interviews with you that I looked at, one of the print interviews, you note that even though you'd lived there for 13 years, you said that you were just beginning to get a grasp, a quote, on the China story, unquote. And I was wondering, what does that mean?
Well, I think it's easy. Sometimes people come to China and they kind of see it from the tour bus window, or they come for, you know, a year or something, and you kind of think that you understand what's going on. But the longer I'm there, I mean, it's a really kind of complicated country, and it has a lot of complex problems. You know, like we mentioned in the beginning, for example, it's got this rising wealthy class, and yet it has this rural population who's still, you know, quite poor. So there's a lot of contradictions in China, and I think the longer I'm there, the longer I see those, and the longer I see that it's not just one kind of thing. The China story is actually many multiple stories.
All right. Well, part of the China story you can read in the book Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration by our guest Michelle Damon-Loyalka. It's published by the University of California Press. She lives in China, has been spending some time here in the United States to talk about the book. And Michelle, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
This fall, visit England and Wales, locations made famous in Last of the Summer Wine, Downton Abbey, and more, including Agatha Christie's home on the coast of South Devon. Does American history suit you? Well, travel in private vintage train cars on our Civil War train. This September's itinerary includes important southern battlefields and discussions with historian Anthony Pitch. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300.
Support for WILL comes from Trent Shepard in recognition of the Artists Against AIDS art show featuring 200 artists, April 26th through 29th at the McKinley Fitness Center, 500 West Church Street in Champaign. More information is available at artistsagainstaids.info.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a midday look at commodities, where Robobank today released a report suggesting that U.S. soybean prices are at high risk of reaching record highs this quarter due to the disappointing South American crop and need for farmers to plant more U.S. acres. Robobank says that soybeans will continue to outperform farm corn as an additional 2 million acres of soybeans are needed beyond the USDA's most recent estimate. Robobank's futures could meet or exceed 2008 record levels, and that was $16.58 a bushel. Robobank also is bullish old crop corn as well, today saying that higher near-term prices are needed to choke off demand amid what will be the tightest U.S. supply situation on record. Robobank cut its current marketing year stockpile projection to 636 million bushels amid additional new Chinese import demand. That would put the stocks-to-use ratio at a record low of 4.9%. USDA's current estimate for old crop ending stocks is at 801 million bushels. Let's go ahead and look at the current tick on the prices. In Kansas City, May wheat at 649.5, up 7 and a quarter.